Welcome back into Steel on Steel. John Loeffler here with you. We opened up a thread a couple of weeks ago on the program when I did a briefing for you on the situation of what is called an escalating regional Cold War. That was the shadow war that was being fought in Gaza. And there is a very important history to all of this, very little of which is being discussed in academia or in the mainline media, which is why I would like to hit it here, since we always try to go after those stories that I think are, number one, critical, and number two, being ignored by the mainline media. There was a very, very good piece written by Jonathan Schanzer in Commentary Magazine called The Iranian Gambit in Gaza. And Jonathan, welcome to the show. I think between these two articles that I've read so far, it provides a very clear picture of what has been going on between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, or Fatah really is what represents them, all the way going back to 1988. And as I read this, it would seem that Hamas has been the core, organ responsible for scuttling whatever has existed of a peace process, and which may very well challenge anything on the part of the Obama administration to create one. Do you think, is that a fair kickoff?
Yeah, absolutely. This is an organization that was founded with the outbreak of the Palestinian Intifada of December 1987. And the organization, if you read its charter, you can find it online in English. And it clearly states that it seeks the destruction of the State of Israel through a violent jihad. And this is an organization that has grown over the last 20 plus years. And there's a power in the Palestinian territories. It controls the Gaza Strip. And it answers largely to the Iranian regime because of the financing and weaponry and training that it receives from the Iranians.
All right. Well, what caused the break originally? Because if you recall, say we go back to about the founding of the what some people call the mullahocracy in Iran. At one time, Yasser Arafat's Palestinian, the PLO, was in bed with the Iranians, but there came a rupture, and that's where Hamas originated.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, when the 1979 revolution took place inside Iran, Yasser Arafat was the first official visitor to come to Iran and to meet with Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the revolution. And the two of them, you can find pictures where they're sitting and holding hands and sharing thoughts about worldwide revolution. And the Palestinians were, for at least a little while, the darlings of the new Iranian regime. Things changed a little bit the following year after the Iran-Iraq war broke out, where Yasser Arafat sided with Iraq and really kind of ticked off the Iranians, but they at least maintained some sort of a relationship. But things essentially unraveled in 1988 when Yasser Arafat accepted the existence of the State of Israel and indicated that his Fatah organization, or the PLO, would begin to negotiate with Israel for a negotiated peace. This was unacceptable to the Iranians, and this is when they began to throw their weight behind the nascent Hamas organization.
In doing so, Hamas then began to do everything that it could to thwart any kind of a peace process.
Well, that's exactly right, and most people don't realize that, you know, when we saw those suicide bombings taking place throughout the 1990s, and we saw it quite often where there would be bombings in restaurants or hotels, and the idea was that the Palestinians, or rather that Hamas, was so dedicated to the destruction of the State of Israel that this was what they were carrying out. In reality, there was another message that they were putting forth, and that was that they would disrupt this peace process by any means necessary. And they were doing so with the financing and training of the Iranian regime. In other words, the Iranians very quickly realized that Hamas was an organization that shared a lot of the same values that they did, were committed to breaking up the peace process, and therefore put a lot of training, a lot of money, and a lot of investment into the Hamas organization, which carried out this gruesome spate of bombings throughout the 1990s.
Okay, so they were the fly in the ointment, so to speak. Really, where everything began to shift again, I would say, was when Yasser Arafat walked away from the negotiating table and really didn't come back with any counter offers. I think the offer that the Israelis made, it was another land for peace deal and was pretty generous. I think it was about, 90-95% of what Arafat wanted. But at that point, he would have had to acknowledge that the war is over, wouldn't he? That would have had to have been the recognition there.
Right. This was actually offered in the year 2000, right at the end of Clinton's term. And it was, according to some sources, it was as much as 96% of the West Bank and all of the Gaza Strip. So just about all the territory that the Palestinians could ask for, as well as sovereignty over Jerusalem and the return of a nominal number of refugees. But the problem was that Yasser Arafat realized that Hamas was gaining popularity, that the Hamas approach of violence against Israel and jihad was something that was winning the hearts and minds of the average Palestinian, and that if he accepted this agreement, he would essentially lose his status as, you know, he really saw himself as Mr. Palestine, and he could really no longer hold on to that mantle. So in the year 2000, he launched what we now call the Second Intifada, the Al-Aqsa Intifada, and he actually joined forces with Hamas, and he had an organization, a terrorist group called the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, which actually began to receive money from Iran. In other words, Iran was successful in bringing Fatah, bringing Arafat's organization into the fold. And what we saw for a short while was that Hamas and Fatah were working together in their war against Israel. The problem was is that Arafat could not out-Hamas the Hamas organization. The Iranians continue to fund Hamas, and Hamas continued to gain in popularity, and slowly the Fatah organization unraveled. The Israelis were pummeling their government infrastructure, and they could no longer operate as a government. And as a result, Hamas was resurgent at that point. And this was really a marked change on the Palestinian landscape. This is essentially the beginnings of what we would see as the Palestinian Civil War.
Right, because as soon as the Israelis withdrew from Gaza in 2005, theoretically there should be no cause for firing missiles into Israel.
That's right.
There's no what you would call legitimate cause.
Right, but the problem was is that Yasser Arafat died in 2004, leaving behind a leadership vacuum that Hamas quickly filled. And when the Israelis did leave Gaza in 2005, Hamas essentially came right in and began to govern. Even though there was a Palestinian Authority that was supposed to be controlling the Gaza Strip, Hamas really filled into Arafat's shoes. And this continued through 2006 when Hamas won the Palestinian legislative elections. And when the Fatah organization refused to relinquish all power, this is essentially what prompted the Hamas organization to launch a coup against the Fatah organization with largely Iranian backing. It was a very violent 6 days in which many people were either pushed off of tall buildings or shot point blank in the limbs. It was mostly Hamas doing this to the Fatah organization. And when the dust settled, Hamas was in control. And this is essentially what we say now is that the Gaza Strip is an Iranian-controlled entity under the auspices of Hamas.
Yeah, it's interesting that back then we didn't hear about the inordinate response on the part of Hamas, did we?
If you look at what happened in the first week of the recent conflict between Israel and the Palestinians and the number of casualties, it were roughly equal to that of what happened in the first week of the Palestinian Civil War of 2007. The difference is the media coverage. When the Israelis and Palestinians engage in hostilities, this is splashed all over the front pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post and leads off the hour on NPR. But when the Palestinians are killing one another, this really shatters the vision that the world has of Palestinian unity, something that Palestinians don't seek to publicize. And the mainstream media throws this to the back of the paper. It's on page 10 or 11 as opposed to the front page of the paper.
But all of this has real-world consequences, because if we are talking about a two-state solution, the real question is it two states or three states? With whom are we dealing? Hamas, Fatah, a combination of the two? And then what are the states going to be, or can there be any state if one of the parties there, Hamas, still keeps threatening the destruction of Israel? Because theoretically, these two states are supposed to live side by side in harmony. You can't have a state on the West Bank or in Gaza and keep lobbing missiles and other attacks into Israel. That's not going to work. So we will address that when we come back. Jonathan Chancer is with me right now. He's the Deputy Executive Director of the Jewish Policy Center in Washington, D.C. His editorial appeared in Commentary Magazine. Their website is jewishpolicycenter.org. This is a thread now we have opened. We're going to have a number of interviews over the course of several weeks here to try to address these issues, because this is going to come roaring back at us in the very near future while we're all preoccupied with economics. We'll be back. I'm John Lefter. The website is steelonsteel.com. The program is Steel on Steel. Oh, you just like that piece because when you played it on the clarinet, you had to make that six note run, you know? And it was always good because you'd be watching it out of the right corner of your eye as you're reading down the sheet of the music while the band's performing. And go, oh no, here it comes. Am I going to blow it? I don't know. I made it. Welcome back to Steel on Steel. I think the only other person that is on the spot in a piece of music is the trumpet player in the middle of the Hallelujah chorus, where he has to make that run, dun, 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 like that. And it's strictly he or she, whoever happens to be playing at that time. And everybody's like, this whole auditorium full of people, there it is. You're right in the middle of this great chorus by Handel. And you have to do this and don't flub it. Remember the bugler at John F. Kennedy's funeral who played taps? That'll go down in memory. Anyway, it's sort of a nice... Welcome back to Steel on Steel. Jonathan Chancer with me, Deputy Executive Director of the Jewish Policy Center. As we went into the break, Jonathan, I was making the point that if we start talking about a two-state, three-state, whatever kind of a multi-state solution, the real question is, with whom are we dealing? This raises real issues and problems that are not easily resolvable, and right now it seems like we're going into this very heavy-handedly.
Well, you know, this is exactly the point of my new book. And what I try to look at in this is just the question of where the interlocutor is. I mean, always in the past, Israel has dealt with one Palestinian people, and traditionally that was under the authority of Yasser Arafat, who was able to bring both sides together. But as you rightly point out, we've got a Gaza Strip that is controlled by Hamas. It is supported and financed by the Iranian axis. The Syrians and the Iranians are behind this. They are an elected government, but they are a terrorist government, and one with which the United States cannot negotiate by essentially looking back at foreign policy that dates back to Richard Nixon, that we do not negotiate with terrorist organizations. On the other hand, you've got the West Bank, which is controlled by the Fatah organization, but this is not an elected organization anymore. It's not an elected government. It is the more moderate of the two parties, but it is illegitimate and weak. So we're in quite a pickle. The Israelis and the Americans are in a pickle. We don't know who to talk with. And if we talk with one and not the other, there's no way that a deal can be inked. So one of the things that I recommend and have been recommending is that we need to stop talking about getting back to the negotiating table right now. We need to actually push things back into the Palestinian court and say, it's time for you to figure out who speaks for you. And once you figure that out, then we can continue to talk things out at the negotiating table. But what we're seeing right now on the part of the Obama administration is a real eagerness to re-engage in the region. And I think it's a mistake. I think that when you start to try to work out a deal before you even know who the interlocutor is, the deal is almost certain to fail. What we don't need right now is another failure in the Middle East. We need to start to string together a few small victories. And even just finding who that interlocutor is could be considered a victory on some level.
Yeah, at least it would force the issue, but it has to be an interlocutor that's recognized by all of the parties there, because if you make an agreement with one party, I mean, we just saw what happened with you make an agreement with Fatah, which ultimately became the Palestinian Authority, and Hamas doesn't go along with it, it doesn't get you anything. You know, they don't observe it. And right now, I don't think Hamas wants to talk. That's the other assumption, is that somebody wants to talk.
Well, that's another incredibly important point here, is that Hamas still seeks the destruction of the State of Israel. Both Hamas and Fatah are meeting in Cairo right now. They've established five separate committees to try to iron out their differences and to put an end to the civil war. But one of the things that Hamas has stated, and stated very clearly, is that even if the two sides are able to come together, they will not accept the State of Israel. That Hamas, if it's part of a new unity government, will not deal with Israel because it sees Israel as illegitimate and needing to be destroyed through jihad. The other thing that's not being talked about is, and what we've been talking about up until now, is the role of Iran. The fact that Iran has been financing and training and providing weapons to Hamas inside the Gaza Strip through smuggling tunnels and through maritime shipments and bulk cash smuggling and all sorts of other things, the fact that Iran is such a player and that it has bought a stake in the game, we cannot ignore that it is going to be a factor in whatever unity government is created, if one is eventually created, if the two Palestinian sides can put aside their differences enough to create a government. We need to talk about the role of Iran. Right now, the international community, the United States, we have not even addressed this problem. We continue to think that this is only an Arab problem when, as you mentioned at the top of the show here, what we're looking at is a regional battle. This is a new Cold War. You've got the United States and the moderate Arab regimes, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, trying to counterbalance that of Iran and Syria and Hezbollah and Hamas. And it's playing out in a microcosm in the Palestinian territories. And this is yet to be, I think, truly recognized by the international community.
Sort of like getting into a poker game, and you just sit down at the table and says, well, quick, make a move. You know, right. Well, what's the game? I don't know. Make a move.
That's exactly, unfortunately, what the Obama administration has done so far. The other thing that I think is probably worth pointing out is that the Middle East has different rules than we have here. When we tell people that we're eager to do something and we set our minds to it, this is the American way. And people respect that. They say, okay, great. There's a will. We'll make it happen. with the Middle East, if you run to the souk, to the open market in Cairo or Istanbul or Jerusalem, and you say, okay, I want to do this and I want to do it in 20 minutes. I want to buy something and I want to get the deal done. You've already put yourself at a disadvantage. They prey on these timetables. And we've already noted that we want to do this very quickly and that we're eager to do it. As soon as you demonstrate that eagerness, you've tipped your hand and the other side will try to take advantage of you. So I think we've really demonstrated some vulnerability on a few fronts so far. But it's not over yet. We still have some time to rebound from this. But I think our first initial moves were too quick and had not been thought out. There's just been such an eagerness to reengage in the region, despite all of its problems, despite all of the violence, despite the rejection of peace. There's just been an eagerness on the part of this administration that, to a certain extent, at least for me, is inexplicable.
Let me expand this just a hair if we could, Jonathan. And that will be the whole area of nuclear weapons and Iran. Iran has crossed the technological threshold, and its attainment of nuclear military capability is now a matter of incorporating the goal of producing an atomic bomb into its strategy, according to OC Military Intelligence Major General Amos Yadlin. This was in the Jerusalem Post from March 8th. We seem to be debating this along the same lines as did Saddam Hussein have weapons of mass destruction.
Well, the Iranian issue is a very difficult one. They've been sort of counting down their development of nuclear weapons. And as we understand, there may be one bomb in Iran's possession already. The Israelis will need to take care of this. And what's interesting is the Israelis have some allies on this. The Arab world is also not interested in allowing the Iranians to get nuclear weapons. The scenario would be a very ugly one, with Iran threatening Israel and being in the same region, and Israel feeling already that it's surrounded on all sides by enemies. This is not a very peaceful scenario. A lot of people think that this could be something akin to the Cold War, where the Muslim world and Israel would sort of face off one another and realize that, okay, both sides can annihilate one another, so there will have to be peace. There'll have to be some sort of mutual agreement where no violence will take place, when in fact nothing could be further from the truth. The Iranians are not rational actors. These are people who believe, or at least some of their leadership believes, that if a nuclear war takes place, that this will herald a messianic figure's return to the world, the 12th Imam, as it's called, and they believe that it's worth losing several million people. The other thing that's also worth thinking about is that Israel is a very small state. If one nuclear weapon hits Israel, it could probably annihilate a quarter to a third of the population and render most of Israel uninhabitable. If Israel responds with one nuclear weapon into Iran, you're looking at a very small percentage. Maybe you're looking at one city that's wiped out, God forbid, but you're still looking at a much smaller proportion of damage. So an Iranian nuclear scenario is a very dangerous one, and Israel will be hard-pressed to find answers on how to neutralize it, particularly because so far the United States, it does not seem interested in helping Israel launch a preemptive attack.
Yeah, it seems like the Saudis almost want this to happen as well, but they can't quite say so above board because we now have the Sunni versus Shia conflict, which is the religious component of this Cold War that's erupting, and they would like to see it happen too, but they just can't say it.
Absolutely. And the Egyptians as well. So it's a question of, do they set aside their differences and work with Israel for a short period of time, or do they just simply leave Israel to its own devices and perhaps pass messages through the United States, letting Israel know what they know or what they'd like to see? So what we see right now is a possible opportunity for the Sunni world to engage in some sort of rapprochement with Israel, but at the same time, you're not seeing a real eagerness to do so, at least up until now. It would be interesting to see if Iran gets closer or if we're able to verify that it does now have a bomb, what the Sunni regimes will do and how they will respond.
Because airspace is a big issue for the Israelis right now in trying to get to Iran. You have to cross over Jordan and over Iraq or come in on some other way. So that's an issue.
The way that it's typically talked about right now is that Israel would need to send its air force up the Mediterranean to bang a right over Turkey, which you would require both Turkish identify friend or foe codes, IFF codes as they're called, and then go over Iraq, which also would require U.S. IFF codes. And what we're seeing right now, at least as I understand it, is a reluctance on the part of all parties, including the United States, to engage in this. In other words, to let the Iranians know that they have given the green light for this would essentially mean being party to the war. And even the Bush administration, before the Obama administration came in, seemed reluctant to do this. And part of the problem has to do with the fact that the attack itself would be probably one of the most complex, if not the most complex, military operation to ever take place in the history of warfare. Looking at needing to have perfect intelligence on more than a dozen nuclear sites and to hit them perfectly, you know, at the exact spot that they needed to be hit several times in a row with very sophisticated U.S.-made munitions, JDAMs and bunker busters and all that sort of stuff. And then once you hit perfectly all those spots that you have with perfect intelligence, then you have to actually fight the conventional forces of the Iranians, their air force, their ground forces, their surface-to-air missiles, and then not to mention the fact that Iran has the proxy.
Let's do a station break. Jonathan Shanser with me right now, a deputy executive director of the Jewish Policy Center. We'll be back. I'm John Loeffler at steelonsteel.com, program Steel on Steel. Nothing like a good cup of hot apple cider during a station break with a big glob of cinnamon in it. That might really taste good. I don't drink much coffee at all. Some people have been asking, welcome back to Steel on Steel, John Loeffler here with you, what the clicking sound is in the back. You obviously recognize it as a moose, a computer moose. And the reason for that is when I used to do the live show in Denver and I'd be interviewing people on the phone, I had a deck of cards with me and I'd play solitaire, which should be called solitary, by the way it's written, but it's solitaire. And now I can have all these card games up on the screen. It gives me something to focus on while I'm doing the show. Our website is steelonsteel.com. You can hear this program 24 hours a day on the internet. We do have subscriptions to our program CDs available. The full subscription is $25 a month, and that gives you a CD a week delivered to your door in the mail. And the best subscription of every month is only $7. It's just one program of each month. We have to pick what we think the best program of that month was. And if you'd like to find out how to get on the subscription list for that, call us toll-free, 1-800-829-5646, 1-800-TAX-JOHN. Just remember that mnemonic if you get around to calling us. We'd never strong-arm anyone. We'll give you the information. You can go month-to-month on this. But for anyone who prepays for 6 months, you actually only pay for 5 months. You get the 6th month for free, which is not a bad deal. That even works for the online subscriptions, 1-800-829-5646. Back to Jonathan Shanser right now from the Jewish Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He has op-ed piece and commentary magazine looking at the whole situation now of how the chessboard has changed in the Middle East, but we're not covering a lot of that in the United States media. The International Atomic Energy Agency has admitted 2 weeks ago that it underestimated Iran's nuclear stockpile by about one-third. And the watchdog group now says that Iran possesses 2,227 pounds of nuclear material, which is sufficient to extract at least one nuclear bomb from that. The stockpile apparently includes about 1,000 kilograms of low-enriched uranium hexafluoride, which gives you about 700 kilograms of the vital uranium-235. U-235 is a fissionable. U-238, the bulk of what uranium is not. So they have to extract the U-235 using centrifuges, and that's what the 6,000 centrifuges are all about. If the consequences is if this standoff does not end in a diplomatically negotiated solution, the consequences are really dramatic because the partner in this nuclear enterprise is Russia. The Russian company Atomstroyexport has provided most, if not all, of the nuclear material for this Bushehr reactor. Iran, of course, threatened to counter any such attack by closing the Straits of Hormuz and launching missiles against the Ras Tanura Gulf oil terminal and also the Saudi oil facility at Abqaiq, which is responsible for about 65% of Saudi oil production. And so it would escalate if they were to do that. At the same time, Israel is sitting there sweating, going, well, do they really have a nuclear bomb? And are they really going to carry out their threat to try to get rid of the Jewish state? And if they do, of course, as well, welcome back, Jonathan Shanser, to you. They have their proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah, so that if this war erupted, we can assume that immediately Hamas and Hezbollah from the various borders around Israel would begin acting as well.
Iran has the proxies that we've already talked about. It has Hamas, it has Hezbollah, it has Syria. And these organizations could also very easily launch barrages of maybe less deadly missiles and rockets, but still deadly missiles and rockets nonetheless. In other words, what we saw in 2006 with Hezbollah launching 10 or 15,000 rockets into Israel would pale in comparison to what Israel would need to deal with if a new war was launched. Hezbollah now has 30,000 rockets based at northern Israel that could probably reach as south as Tel Aviv. Then you've got an arsenal of chemical weapons in Syria, as well as the Qassam and Grad and Fajr and Katusha rockets that we saw just in December and January in the Gaza Strip. So we're looking at a very dangerous scenario for Israel should it choose to launch this preemptive attack. And I think it's one of the reasons why we haven't seen other countries get on board yet. The goal, I think, though, for Israel in the long run is to find a coalition, NATO allies or European allies along with the United States and maybe even those Sunni regimes to all get on board with this so that Israel is not singled out and that Iran comes under immense either political, diplomatic, or perhaps even military pressure. But again, all of this still remains to be seen, a very fluid situation.
Yeah, you're right. It's very, very fluid. The old rules of the peace process is in effect dead, no matter what people are saying. And so the new rules have now established. And sooner or later, Israel is going to feel itself compelled to act regardless of what happens for the obvious situation. But also, there's always this habit of shooting oneself in the foot. And I don't mean on the part of the Israelis. That tends to happen in the Arab world a lot, where if somebody does the wrong thing, countries in Europe and elsewhere would have a motivation for acting as well, meaning some kind of terrorist event or something like that. So this whole picture, it's very fluid, very unstable, and it can slush one way or the other very quickly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I would say that there are some other factors at play here. If Israel does neutralize Hamas, let's say in another future operation, it would take out one of the sort of chess pieces that Iran has. Similarly, if it takes out Hezbollah, it's got the opportunity to do that. So in other words, I mean, there are opportunities that can swing back into Israel's favor or in America's favor, but I think you're right that the peace process is essentially dead. That the Fatah organization is corrupt and ossified and does not represent the Palestinian people. Hamas probably represents the Palestinian people more than the fact that it is an elected government from 2006. So right now, the feeling on the ground is that there's not a lot of room for peace. What's interesting is that the Obama administration is engaged right now in peace talks with the Syrians. And the feeling is right now, and this was, the same exact thinking in 1992 when Bill Clinton came into office, that if Syria were somehow to be swayed, that if Syria could somehow be flipped out of the Iranian orbit and into the Western U.S. orbit, that this would set off a domino effect of others who would have to agree to engage in peace talks and perhaps ink agreements with Israel. I don't see the logic of this. I don't believe that Syria is ready or willing or able to engage in serious peace talks with Israel, but this is what our administration is pursuing right now. There are those who say that it doesn't hurt to talk. I would say that we're probably just wasting time not dealing with the issues that are truly pressing. And I think just sort of chasing our tail over there. But again, all of this is still fluid and still remains to be seen.
Ah, but the stuff of great future movies, you must admit that. You know? So I don't know. Anyway, Jonathan Chancer, you have a book out. Tell people about it. Any websites you'd like to mention for our listeners?
Sure. My new book is called Hamas versus Fatah, The Struggle for Palestine. It came out in November, and the publisher is Palgrave Macmillan. You know, I think people have been finding it very useful over the last couple of months as we try to figure out why the two sides are fighting and why they're meeting in Cairo and why they're not able to come together for a unity government and why we can't figure out who the interlocutor is. So that's what the book is, Hamas versus Fatah, The Struggle for Palestine. And the organization that I work for is called the Jewish Policy Center. It's jewishpolicycenter.org, and we have a journal we put out quarterly, and you can sign up for our weekly email mailings, which many of them feature articles that I write, like the Commentary Magazine piece that you mentioned. And I have also a personal website, which is just shanzer.pundicity.com. That's shanzer.pundicity, PUNDICITY.com.
Jonathan Chancer, thank you really much. I appreciate it. This